Chick.
You are
into the quarter to three movie podcast. This week we will be discussing The Green Zone, directed by Paul Greengrass, starring...
Just Green Zone.
No definite article, you're sure? A Green Zone. We're discussing A Green Zone.
That's the Coens.
I have here with me Christian Makowski.
That's pretty good, but you... Yeah, it is, actually. You can just call me Freddy, though.
And I also have Kelly Wand. Do you have a tagline for us this week?
I did. I wrote one this week for a change. Ready for it?
Rock and roll.
America is the Activision of the free world.
Ouch. Wow.
That's take some... that, free world.
before we get to a plot synopsis, Kelly Wand, I want you to explain to the listeners, there will be spoilers, by the way, what happens in the Green Zone. What did you guys think of that opening music? Did that work for you?
I thought it was the Battlestar Galactica podcast.
Oh, okay. First of all, Kelly Wand, you are fired. Battlestar Galactica did its best to ruin All Along the Watchtower. Didn't succeed. That song is still great.
Yeah, because it existed before hundreds of thousands of years before Jimi Hendrix.
Well, that wasn't the Jimi Hendrix version. And by the way, isn't it a Bob Dylan song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
No, I think it's U2.
Bob Dylan is our Jimi Hendrix, the white.
But it's, but it is from the album Green Haze, right?
Yeah.
I love this is one of my favorite instances of misheard lyrics. There's a line about, please stand here, drink my wine, come and dig my herb. Now, I don't know if you guys know that that's what, you know what?
Kind of the acting.
Here we go.
Drink my wine. Come and dig my herb. Well, we might still be recorded.
So, there you go. He says, please to stand there, drink my wine, come and dig my herb, right? Isn't that what you guys heard?
It's Earth.
Well, it's... No,
we didn't hear any of the music, actually. The music cut off, and we couldn't hear any of it. So,
well, the listeners can hear it. You guys don't count.
Are we still recording?
As far as I know, yes. Anyway, the line is actually, businessmen drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth.
Yeah, earth.
Yeah. Welcome to Earth.
That's the one. That's the version they submitted to Ed Sullivan.
I like that. So anyway, that was this week's opening song. And try as it might, Battlestar Galactica did not destroy it. Dingus, you'll get to that part when you finish watching the series, Battlestar Galactica.
Ugh. Thanks for spoiling it, guys.
Kelly Wand, what happens in The Green Zone?
Well, they don't spend much time in The Green Zone. It's kind of like in Fargo when they don't really go to Fargo.
Oh.
I didn't write that. I just said it. I can do that at will. But anyway, getting back to the movie we're talking about. So Matt Damon is Jason Bourne, and we invade Iraq, and he is sent to a toilet factory to find some chemical warfare. And after the fifth toilet factory in a row, he gets tired of it and whines to his bosses. And something about Jack Clubs. Oh, and then we win the war. So... everything works out. It's Matt Damon sends an email to everybody. Remember that famous incident in 2003 when the soldier sent the email to the Wall Street?
So I just want
to Hardball. He also sent it to Hardball.
Was Fox News on the CC list? Did they get CC'd on that?
They got CC'd in Edge of Darkness, and in this, the Wall Street Journal is the Washington Post instead of Fox News. That bleeding heart rag, the Wall Street Journal. Wants the truth about the war.
All right. Well done, Kelly Wand. That was excellent. So before we start, I just want to apologize to Avatar for thinking that it was as facile as we could possibly be. Dangers of neo-colonialism.
Thanks, James Cameron.
Yeah. I'm really sorry, James Cameron. I didn't know.
Who knew James Cameron would beat Paul Greengrass?
Yeah.
Democracy is messy. Times two.
You don't decide what happens here.
You know what sucks is this movie's didn't do very well this weekend, and so the narrative is, oh, see Iraq war movies, no one's ready for them. Instead of, no one's ready for a movie that looks like a Jason Bourne movie, but it's about Iraq. You know what I'm saying?
I think no one's ready for a bad political thriller. Just really
right. Exactly. That's not going to be what everyone's going to. They're going to go, oh, see, Iraq. Oh, you can't make movies about Iraq.
Hurt Locker, hello. Best picture of last year, I understand.
Yeah, well, that's all there because they go, despite Hurt Locker winning the Oscar, Iraq War movies are still poison at the box office. And that's what the conclusion's going to be because all these stupid ass articles.
So it didn't do well this weekend.
No, it bombed, and Alice in Wonderland took the cake again.
Well, it's the better movie. Now, yeah. Real quick, did anyone here like The Green Zone?
I like the acting. And I like the handheld, but I didn't know what to make of that ending.
Dingus, did you like The Green Zone? Because I know you're conflicted about the whole Iraq War thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I carry a constant load of guilt about supporting it. I have a love-hate relationship with this film in that I loved a couple of the action scenes, especially at the beginning. The lead-up to the sniper scene and... driving through the traffic. I thought the traffic scenes were great, perfect for what Paul Greengrass can do. But it just turns out to be so clunky that it was just painful, utterly painful.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're all on the same page. Let's go to this week's 3x3.
Yeah. Well, at the end, can I ruin the ending? Because to me, it ruins the movie.
I think the movie is ruined far before the ending. But go ahead.
Well, the ending matters a lot because it's basically like, okay, did no one listen to him? Was that the implication? Or was he court-martialed? Or was he reassigned? Or did he change history like in Inglourious Basterds? Like, what happened after that last shot? Did nothing happen?
My theory is, now this is based on a book which I haven't read and now have no desire to read. Kelly Wand, you are our resident source material expert. Do you know anything about this book?
I didn't read the book, but it's just about the Green Zone and what conditions were like there, and it has nothing.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It's just life in the Emerald City.
Right. It's not this political thriller that's intended to be the invasion of Iraq in a microcosm.
No, they could have said it's about the Valerie Plame book just as much.
And the guy who wrote it,
the Joe Wilson character.
Yeah, the guy who wrote it, Rajiv Chandrasekharan. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. He's always on. He's been on a lot of the political. He goes on political talk shows from time to time and
Holy
even on Fresh Air and just, you know, to give information. It's really just as Kelly Wand said, when I saw his name pop up at the end, I was like, what? I mean, it's got to be loosely.
Who's his character in the movie?
That's hilarious to me because I just assumed that this was some dippy, like Scott Ludlow, or no, what's the guy? Scott Turow pot boiler that happened to be set in Iraq. I cannot believe, wow.
Scott Turow is actually very good. You need to say that.
Who's the guy that's no good that does the client and all those legal books?
John Grisham.
Grisham.
You have to say John Grisham. You can't say Scott Turow.
Okay.
J.K. Rowling.
I apologize to Scott Turow as well as James Cameron now.
James Patterson.
I cannot believe this because now here's the thing. I think there is room, and I appreciate kind of what they were trying to do. There's a place for a thriller that touches on certain issues like this, and I appreciated what Paul Greengrass seemed to be trying to do, which is let's just set this political thriller in Iraq, and in the course of telling this story, we will touch on important issues, such as the failure of the press, what a disaster it was when L. Paul Bremer disbanded the Iraqi army, how al-Maliki was a total boondoggle, and about how the CIA, the country's actual intelligence agency, was shut out in favor of cooked-up bullshit from the Pentagon. I love the idea that let's make a political thriller and touch on these issues.
Yeah.
But it was so poorly done, and there was no thrill. In a way, the Inglourious Basterds thing is kind of funny because you know how it's going to end up. So there's no tension there, really. And the fact that it seems to be laying at the feet of this utterly implausible soldier, you know, this Roy Miller character, it seems to be laying at his feet this almost Woodward and Bernstein, all the president's men type credit for busting open the truth about WMDs.
Yeah.
When that is not at all what happened. It's just that people finally fucking woke up and saw what the Bush administration had done.
Right.
It was people coming to their senses and not one guy publishing a report and then CCing the press.
Joe Wilson is the closest thing to that you get, and he was a reporter.
Valerie Plame's husband.
Yeah.
Even then, no, that was just the...
The idea that the soldier is a big part of the movie's narrative mechanism, and it's like, oh, it's a soldier doing it. Whoa, this is... And so the implications of his actions are never even addressed.
And that's, all of that stuff was so
stupid, too.
I mean, you know, soldiers were there. It was like his main sidekick buddy, and I don't know the ranks, who says, look, we're just here to do a job. That's one of the big successes of the Iraq War is how well the military has acquitted themselves at doing a really tough job when they were handed, you know, when they were there weren't enough men there, they weren't given enough equipment, they hunkered down and they did what they were sent to do as best as they could. Mm-hmm. And to then suppose that one man saw through all of this and fought for the truth and was insubordinate and reckless, like all of that was
and gets away with it.
Yeah,
apparently. You have no sense for what you're – I think one of you said this, and it might have been Kelly. You have no sense for what the consequences are going
right.
to be.
And that's the most interesting part of the movie to me, or the plot, is like, oh, if a soldier did this, what would happen? I mean, that hasn't actually happened. So, I mean, are we supposed to assume that it did or should?
Well, what this book presupposes is that it did.
Oh. That was Owen Wilson, the author.
Except you didn't do the accent right, Dingus. Go back and work on that.
I'm not going to be able to do that for you.
I do hope, by the way, anybody who thought the Hurt Locker was unrealistic is just going to have a field day with this one. This, as a political thriller, the portrayal of like how the military works was so just sloppy.
Especially after you've seen Generation Kill, and you have, if you watch that, it totally ruins the dialogue in this movie.
Yeah.
Because it feels so less authentic.
Well, and part of the problem, too, Hurt Locker is very much a psychological thriller. This is trying to be a political thriller, which is very procedural as well. And if you're going to have a thriller about procedural stuff, you kind of need to honor the way it really works, unless you're going to do some stylized thing, which I don't know, maybe that's what Greengrass was trying to do. You know, like maybe there's this idea that Matt Damon represents how the common soldier in Iraq was duped.
Worthy subject matter for a movie.
Right. And like I said, I think there's room for a thriller that could be done like this. But the biggest problem with this, as well as just being really glib about all of these subjects that it touched on, the biggest problem was it just wasn't a very good thriller.
No. So well, a one-legged Deus Ex Machina beats Damon at the buzzer at the end.
Well, who didn't see that coming? I mean, I knew that Freddie was going to do that. You know, he scrambles under the
seat
and he grabs his gun, and I'm like, okay, I see they're all going to converge, and he's going to do that. I mean, you see that coming down Fifth Avenue, and you just have to sort of bite your finger and wait for it to happen.
I bit my finger and waited for it to end. And then his line, oh, you don't get to decide what happens here. Like, he's just made that true. He's just fulfilled – like, he just screwed the one chance he had of saving his country.
Which, again, if you want to make that a political point about Iraq, fair enough. Let's do a good thriller and make that her button. But by the time we got to that point, I was so over this stupid movie.
Well, the problem is the movie, for me, it's not the thrilling parts that are the problem. It's that it just keeps tripping over its own dialogue. It keeps trying so hard to put lines like democracy is messy in there twice in the same scene. It tries so hard to get this political crap shoehorned in there that it just – the lines are just constantly landing with a thud. And there's a scene early on where Matt Damon is walking with I forget his name. He's a guy. His name's Michael O'Neill, I think. He's a guy who was a Secret Service, the guy who did the Secret Service stuff on The West Wing. And they're walking through the compound right after the first time Matt Damon discovers the toilet factory, and the guy's doing all this crappy soundbitey stuff, and you have so much soundbite stuff that's just awful.
And then they wind up in the briefing room, and Matt Damon is talking straight to people. I'm like, oh, okay, I see there's supposed to be a juxtaposition here. But then later on, Matt Damon has to say some of that stuff. He's like, on the walkie-talkie, he's saying, if we can get this guy to talk, we're going to find the truth out about WMD. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, I just, every time somebody says one of those lines, it just lands with a clang.
Yeah, Tom.
I liked some of the hardware. Like, I loved it. You think as you're talking about the opening scene with the sniper and they're trying to get into the factory. I love the sound of those M249s, and I love those Black Hawk helicopters, especially early on when they come in and bring Jason Isaacs in. yeah. Some of that stuff was just so, just as far as production value, some really nice stuff there. I liked some of that. And, oh, here's the thing. I loved Jason Isaacs. I wanted the movie to be about him. Jason Isaacs made a fantastic, like, badass Delta Force dude.
Yeah, it was totally cool to see him do that after seeing him play, you know, the Captain Steele in Black Hawk Down. You know, it was so cool to see him on the other side of that.
And I loved when he kicked Matt Damon's ass and frisked him for the book.
In front of his men.
In front of his men. He basically did the equivalent of giving him a wedgie, a Delta Force wedgie. That was awesome. He un-velcroed his vest and was patting him down. I was like, yeah, awesome. I was cheering for the wrong guy at that point, which is a bad sign.
But Damon pickpockets, reverse pickpockets a guy in front of all of his men and the Delta Force guy and isn't seen doing it.
I did love his line to Matt Damon as he left, too. I think he says, have a nice war.
Yeah, that was good. It was a throwaway, too.
So, by the way, is the movie asking us to suppose that the Delta Force guys were in league with Greg Kinnear's L. Paul Bremer?
Yeah, they were Blackwater.
No, they weren't. They were definitely military. They were not contractors. They were called Special Forces, which I presume is Delta Force.
I think they were actually, somebody said they were Delta at some point.
Okay. But they were sent, so Greg Kinnear can get on his phone and send them to murder rather than capture a high-value target. Was that the idea, that they were in league with Greg Kinnear?
Yeah. But then they got distracted by Matt Damon.
That sort of thing is so cheesy, too. I mean, they might as well have been twirling their mustaches. God, that was so lame.
Well, yeah, he had plenty of mustache to twirl. Yeah.
That's true. That was some awesome facial hair.
Well, for me, what the moment, one of the moments that really, really made my heart sink, and this is really late in the movie, it's after the climactic battle scene and everything, that Matt Damon's character, Roy Miller?
Roy Miller, yeah. How about that for an awesome action hero name?
Hmm. No, Chief Hansen.
Very nice. He walks away at the end from Freddy hopping and killing the general.
Yeah, ruining the entire plan.
And he doesn't do anything to help the Special Forces guy.
I thought he was dead.
Well, if that's not clear to me. It's clear that the guy has been shot and he's down, but he's a soldier who's down.
Right.
And if in a normal movie where a soldier is in this circumstance, he's going to help his buddy.
And well, that would have been pointless, too, is if he carried him away.
Or if he'd done something, if he'd gone to see, is he okay? In the heat of battle, I mean, this is...
He didn't help the helicopter guys either.
Yeah, there's no sense, you know, beyond that first scene... which I really did love when they're driving. In fact, the two driving scenes, which were sort of replicated from each other, you know, the second one where they get caught in traffic, and the first one where they're driving, and you can't really see people as you go by. They're a blur. It's hard to focus on people. It's hard to focus on the people in the background. And then there's all the looters, and it's really difficult to get a sense of who's who and who's where. I think that Paul Greengrass is really good at getting that down, and that's really well done. Especially the looter stuff. I really like that they added the looter stuff in there.
Again, it's another thing where they touch on an important issue in the invasion of Iraq. Let's give this a little point in the plot. Yeah,
kind of like Men Who Stare at Goats did.
Oh, good lord.
Well, you know, I interrogation stuff. Sorry, go on.
No, I'm glad you said that, Kelly Wand, because I couldn't help but think about Men Who Stare at Goats when they were going into the interrogation rooms.
Yeah.
And how that was handled there and how it was handled here.
Now, I'm not sure you guys know this, but Delta Force was conducting interrogations in Iraq. How about that? That just blew the lid off that right there.
And Bremer was watching them all.
That's right. So actually he wasn't, because I was thinking, okay, he's L. Paul Bremer, but they reference L. Paul Bremer later in the movie, and they point
it's
out
Jay.
That Greg Kinnear... What?
It's J. Paul Bremer, by the way.
I like L better.
Yeah, and I thought that, too. I thought, okay,
J. Paul Getty. What are you...
He's supposed to be... Go ahead. Supposed to be Paul Bremer. But then later in the movie, when they're doing the announcement, they actually mention Bremer's name, and I'm like, crap, I thought Kinnear was Bremer.
Right, no, Kinnear was a Pentagon. They even give his title at some point. He was...
Who was that other dude supposed to be? That... Like high ranking suited dude. Was that supposed to be Rumsfeld? Oh, that was Bremer? Okay.
No,
The guy came off the helicopter and Kinnear's sucking up to him on the airfield.
Maliki?
Halabi?
Yeah, maybe it was Maliki. I'm dumb. Go on. Never mind.
So I also enjoyed Amy Ryan playing Judith Miller. That was cute.
And what a name.
But what's your name?
Laurie Dane.
Laurie Dane. And it's spelled L-A-W-R-I-A-N-E.
Oh, that's right.
D-A-Y-N-E. Laurie
that makes
Dane.
For a memorable byline.
So her big payoff scene is the hotel room where she just goes,
She feels bad. Yeah, exactly. Kelly Wand, let's hear again your
Laurie
representation
Dane
of Laurie Dane's guilty confession. Go.
Well, I haven't actually met Magella. Okay, let me know if you need anything. I'll be in this room. You won't see me till the end. Email me if you come up with it.
And the funny thing is, Amy Ryan is a fantastic actress. I love that woman. And what a waste. God,
yeah.
What a...
I love her too, and I actually really liked her in that scene. I think there's a moment in that scene.
Not her fault.
Well, yeah, it's not her fault, and she doesn't have a lot to do. It's kind of unfair, but she has a moment where she's talking about the raw intelligence, and there's this excitement and this fire in her eyes when you realize that the whole point of this was access, and the whole point of her involvement when he asks, did anybody verify any of this, is that for her that didn't matter. It was access to her. It was having the raw intelligence. It was being part of it. That, you know, it was the adrenaline rush, and she shows that there. Now she doesn't have a lot to show when it's you know, kind of hitting us over the head with, yes, the press were part of the problem. But I think she does a fine job there, and I kind of liked her in that scene. I like her anyway.
Yeah.
So it wasn't all for me. I liked her there.
No, not at first, but I mean, she threatens Greg Kinnear, like, okay, I've had enough of your stonewalling me. I'm gonna do something. And then she never does anything. Like, Matt Damon comes, and then she acts like, oh, yeah, I haven't met Magellan, yeah.
Well, the poor girl, one of the first things she has to say is the line, you're the administration's go-to guy. And how do you say that? I mean, it's just so, what?
You pulled it off pretty well there, Dingus.
Yeah.
I like your reading.
You're kind of our Amy Ryan.
Yeah, I think of that, too. If this were the Gone Baby Gone podcast, sure.
Okay, so the movie peaked for me. This is where I liked it the most, and everything was downhill from here. And this is where I briefly was like, okay, maybe this is going to work. When Freddie confesses, I left my leg in Iran, that was the movie's only, like, really human moment where I felt, wow, this is – let's tell this story. Let's hear from this guy.
Yeah. So
follow this guy more often. I loved that moment where they're chasing him and you find out he's got a limp because he's got a fake leg, and he references, you know, Iraq's past and with the war with Iran. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
So there
that's when the movie's still about human beings instead of sound bites and mouthpieces, which everyone turns into in the last 10 minutes.
You know what? You're right, Kelly Wand. There is really no character, really, and they give Freddie this very briefly, but there really are no memorable characters here. They are all just like placeholders.
Yeah, including Damon.
God, he was just a non-entity as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, you know what? The name Roy Miller is perfectly appropriate. If we're going to have a boring soldier like that, sure, give him a boring name.
And I really loved that Freddie guy.
Well, you know where you've seen him before. That's the main terrorist from United 93.
I had no idea. And I was meaning to sort of take a look at that movie again, but it's not really a movie you can just take a look at.
No.
Yeah, the actor's name is Khalid Abdallah. He was in United 93, and he's unforgettable in that. But then he was also the lead, and he's terrible in this, in Kite Runner, which is Mark Forster's movie based on the novel about a really morose guy from the Middle East. and Khalid Abdallah is just... Oh, he's so bad in that. But I loved him as Freddy. I was like, wow, give this guy more material. Let's follow him some more.
You know, I loved him too, and there were little moments like that and a couple other little moments which kept giving me hope. I mean, for me, it felt like, for a while, it felt like two different movies. It felt like this really cool battle thriller that Paul Greengrass was doing a great job with, like I said before, with the whole sort of unmoored camera and difficulty of focusing that really worked for me, and then this clunky political stuff that would take place with Greg Kinnear. And you'd have a couple of moments that would give me hope. Like right after that moment you're talking about where he says, my leg is in Iran, Matt Damon ends up going into the green zone for the first time. You actually see him go past a sign that says green zone, I think. And as he's driving in, you see this passing shot. It's a quick shot of these tourists taking a picture in front of, I think it's a some sort of big vehicle, big army vehicle. And it's just a quick passing shot. There's a bunch of there's like one guy taking a picture of like a couple of girls in front of a tank. Or a Bradley vehicle, something like that, and I like that little touch real quick. And or when they went into the palace and there's the pool and the soldiers ask, can we have a beat? Can we have
beer? That was great.
I like little moments like that, and then they just kept slamming down the message of the film from quotes from the press that we know about, like democracy is messy, that made me just feel like, oh, come on. There's got to be a way you can do this without making us feel like you're putting something around our neck.
Or put something real around my neck. Like the fact that I remember when we invaded Iraq, the media was just in a pot. Like they were just – they all wrapped themselves in the flag. And the ones who like spoke out against it, like your Michael Moores, your Gene Garofalo, those were ridiculed. So the fact that Amy Ryan plays this like, oh, there's the media that's trying to get the real story. No, they got embedded in all those units, military units, and like just became – jingoists.
Right, right.
And that's not touched on at all in the movie.
Well, you know, I think it is, Kelly Wand, just in that they have that one little scene where she tries to be contrite about swallowing the administration's line. You know, that right there is the movie's, like with so many other issues, that's the movie trying to remind us of this one little point and fit it into the context of this really stupid, superficial story.
But she has a conscience. So.
Well, I think the media does it as well. I mean, I think the media totally came around as far as it couldn't help but come around with after the, you know, right now the mission accomplished thing is he's widely derided for that. I don't think the media is
belatedly.
Right. Belatedly. Just like Amy Ryan in the hotel room feeling bad.
They came around after it was too late, basically.
Well, right, right. And same with Amy Ryan. Same with Amy Ryan. She came around after it was too late. That right there is the movie. Just like, for instance, one of the huge – there's a great book by Thomas Ricks called Fiasco and he points out, and I agree with this, that one of the biggest missteps in the aftermath of the invasion was disbanding the Iraqi army. That right there fucked us royally. That right there was you can trace so much to that one stupid decision. And so what Paul Greengrass does – is when they have this announced at a press conference, I love this, everyone in the room goes, oh!
And you have Brendan Gleeson in the meeting early on go, I predict that if you do this in 6 months, there'll be civil war. I guarantee it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I feel like that, you know, the media did come around and Paul Greengrass wanted to represent that. Or you know what? I really feel we should blame Helgeland for so much of this stuff. Paul Greengrass, it seems to me, was just given a really, really crappy script.
Why did they? It wasn't very nuanced.
I mean,
it doesn't, I don't get why they decided to do this, because, you know, they made these, the Bourne films, and you're going to have the inevitable comparison to, say, Bourne in Iraq, which is
like they tried
it really isn't, because
he, get the studio to go, yeah, look, it's a Bourne movie, but it's got a message.
Right.
Like Avatar.
I just don't get why they decided to do this. It's bizarre.
Well, I really do think so. Here's my theory. So Paul Greengrass is a really nuanced guy as far as understanding tough political issues, and you can see that in Bloody Sunday, and you can see that in United 93.
Mm-hmm.
He's a sensitive filmmaker. He's a smart guy. He knows how to handle tough issues and distill them into fantastic, you know, hour and a half, 2 hour, bite sized packages. But my theory here is it's Matt Damon's pull, like it's his celebrity appeal. It's Brian Helgeland being, I don't know, maybe a little oblivious or something.
I blame Helgeland for everything.
I'll go with you on it. So I know him from Payback.
The acting's fine.
Payback, Helgeland was fine with that, but what has he done since Payback, Kelly Wand?
Knight's Tale.
That was before, wasn't it? Or that maybe that was after Payback, yeah.
We worked together on Dirty Harry.
But has he been pumping out crappy scripts? Is that
well, wasn't L.A. Confidential, wasn't that him?
Yeah, but that was before.
And that's also from a book, wasn't it? Wasn't that from a James Ellroy novel?
Yeah, one of those guys.
That's what he's doing.
So he
also wrote Robin Hood coming out.
Oh,
at least
boy.
Robin
Ouch.
Hood. Ready. And Sergei Dufresne, Tom's favorite.
But that's also based on a book, Kelly Wand. So they...
and Taking a Pelham 1-2-3.
Oh, ouch.
And Man on Fire. And The Order.
Oh,
okay. Watch. Check, please.
And The Postman.
Holy cats. Yeah, this is all Brian Helgeland's fault. And I think Matt Damon was just clueless enough to get swept up in this. And poor Paul Greengrass now looks like a doofus.
You know, Matt Damon is not a clueless guy. He's a smart guy. I don't understand how this happens. He's not a dopey actor. He's a smart guy.
Yeah, but smart in the... So the funny thing about this is I agree with all of the politics behind Green Zone.
Well, me too, but
right.
It's just so painful.
Right. Yeah. It's just so... Exactly. It's just so painfully...
But it's not going to convert anyone. It's like it's preaching to the choir.
Well, it's not going to convert anyone because no one's going to see it sounds like.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I we think it. is like some of the people in the Hurt Locker thread who had some... you know, arguments with how that film went, taking this as more ammunition for films like In the Valley of Allah and awful political films that are just using the Iraq War poorly and don't have no idea. And I just want to say, don't look at this. You don't get to use this as your ammunition, but they're going to get to.
Well, here's my theory on this. The invasion of Iraq, and Dingus, you call it the Iraq War, and I take issue with that. This is not a war. This is an invasion.
It's police action.
The Iraq incident.
No, we were invited. Did you hear what Dana Perino said? The Iraq invited us to invade them.
Ugh. Anyway, the invasion of Iraq was not a thriller. The invasion of Iraq was a bureaucratic misadventure, which is why go ahead, Kelly Wong.
I'm sorry. I'll be quiet.
Anyway, that's what I was going to say, so I'm done.
I'm agreeing with you.
I had that in my notes as well, but I wanted to bring it up to hear what you had to say about it, because I kept getting so frustrated with the political dialogue in this, because it was lifted directly from the sound bites we hear, but there was nothing supporting them. There was no context given. There was no sort of fleshing out to understand why Greg Kinnear would just blurt out the words. And I said this 17 times during this podcast, that democracy is messy, which I don't know who said that. I think it was Rumsfeld, but I'm not completely sure. And it just felt blurted out. It felt soundbitey, and it didn't feel like a cohesive part of the scene. And if you're going to use these actual parts of history, then give us something to go on, something to sink our teeth into. And as I was thinking about this and brainstorming, and then also thinking about the 3x3 to come and watching a couple movies for that, I did finally come around to thinking about In the Loop, and I wanted to hear what you had to say about that, Tom.
Because I think what happened there was a matter of mid-level bureaucracy stuff. I mean, the administration, and I don't want to talk too much about the politics. We could get into that. But the administration, the way the administration used 9/11 as a pretense very successfully for us to move into Iraq, all of that was about bureaucracy, was about high-level political stuff. And all of that was a Doctor Strangelove level comedy as far as like how I think this is going to be remembered and how it's best captured in a story. And In the Loop does the perfect job of doing this, capturing the essence of everything that happened, and it never even has to use the word Iraq, which is the beauty of that movie, and why it succeeds 100 times more than Green Zone as far as being about what actually happened and being a cautionary tale and being a real thoughtful examination of what everything meant and how it all happened. I just feel that when you try to cast it as a political thriller where one man navigates this incident, like a Woodward and Bernstein through all the president's men, as I said earlier, that's not the level on which everything that happened in Iraq. It did not happen at that level. It was not one dirty little secret discovered by two reporters. You know, this was a huge bureaucratic incident that transcends, you know, Roy Miller. And I just thought it was ridiculous to try to capture it in that kind of storytelling. Go ahead, Dingus.
Well, what I was going to say was what occurred to me as you were talking would be really cool to see would be the combat corollary to In the Loop. So In the Loop, it gives everything that you're talking about without showing a moment of combat.
Right.
And what would be really cool would be to see a combat film like Green Zone, but without having any of the political at all.
Yeah.
Well, and we've got that. I mean, I think that's what Generation Kill did so well, is because on the boots on the ground level of Iraq was acquitted admirably, and it was done by guys basically doing their jobs, and I imagine a lot of the time it was very boring, and it involved tension with commanders and how groups were sent around. I mean, Generation Kill is such a great picture of the low-level operations in Iraq that has nothing really to do with the high-level mismanagement of everything. They're so completely divorced, and Green Zone tries to tie them together, and it just doesn't work because that's not what happened. I think we've got that, and I think Generation Kill did a fantastic job with that.
Well, I think you're right. I think Generation Kill does a phenomenal job with that. But what I would like – but that's sort of showing us rolling in.
Right.
And what I would like is something that shows the occupation in as ridiculous a way, but not making it cartoonish, but
shows
that sense of
the
being
black
there. What'd you say?
Like the black comedy of it, in a way.
Exactly.
Like 5 years later, Generation Kill.
Yeah. Or just 5 weeks later or 5 months later. Just that sense of being in the Green Zone and how effed up it is.
Right.
I want a Blackwater movie.
Oh, God. Green Zone does touch on that, Dingus, in the way that it closes with Peter Sarsgaard? Yeah, with Peter Sarsgaard wanting to disarm some of the bombs. And I mean, it definitely there are brilliant hints of what's going to come. But yeah, I'm with you.
Green Zone or Green Zone? You just said Green Zone. Oh, you meant Generation Kill.
Oh yeah, sorry. Right. The last episode, I think it's even called, oh gosh, something about bombs in the Garden of Eden. It has a very poetic title. But anyway, the closing of Generation Kill does touch on some of what's going to come. And I agree with you. I would love to see more of that boots on the ground storytelling about the later occupation. Yeah.
Did you guys see The Pacific tonight?
Did not. No.
Did you see it?
Yeah.
I don't have. Is that HBO? I don't have HBO.
Oh. Did you guys see W?
You know, oddly enough, Kelly Wan, one of my favorite. This is another problem I kind of had with Green Zone and the portrayals of the war. The war. Listen to me. Of the invasion of Iraq in general. It was not about WMDs. It was not about oil. It was not about human rights abuses. It was not about toppling a repressive dictator. One of the few cinematic representations of the invasion of Iraq that I feel actually understands what went on is in W, when Rumsfeld pulls down. Is it Scott Glenn playing Rumsfeld? I forget. Anyway, he's addressing the cabinet and George Bush, and he pulls down. He does a little presentation where he explains, look, if we get Iraq as a stable, secular, free enterprise democracy in the Middle East, here's what it'll do for us. And he sort of shows this reverse domino effect. It's all this Cold War thinking of how it will then spread stability in the Middle East. And as glib as I thought W was also as a movie, I was like, well, yeah, you know, that there we go. That's why we went there. You know, that
shows him going through Iran to get to it.
Oh, does it really?
Yeah. That's the best scene in W. It's totally worth the price of admission. Where he has the pointer and he's showing the map.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I love that scene. The rest of the movie's not as good as that.
Right.
It's a great 5-minute breakdown of 6 years of invasion.
Yeah, so everybody, instead of watching The Green Zone, rent W and fast forward to that scene, and you'll be fine.
And Generation Kill.
And In the Loop.
Yeah, and In the Loop. Ugh.
There was one more thing that occurred to me, that this has nothing to do with the excellent points you guys just made, is that they actually showed the soldiers watching the mission accomplished speech, which they had also showed, and neither of you are going to have any idea what I'm talking about, had showed a couple soldiers earlier watching a college basketball game.
Oh, right. They were catching up on their hoops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were watching UCLA versus Oregon.
Pac-10.
But the mission accomplished speech took place in May, and college basketball is well in over by then.
Dang it, you cracked the code.
Yeah, that's a good catch, actually.
You just found out the truth about Green Zone. You need to send that to the press.
I'll be happy to, since today the brackets for March Madness came out, and you can't get that by me.
Yeah.
Was it only 3 months later that he did the mission accomplished thing?
I don't remember, but it didn't really work with him, unless they were watching like tapes of an old.
I thought he brought a turkey, and that was Thanksgiving, and then we invaded like the March before, so it was like 9 or 10 months, wasn't it?
Was this movie? I don't remember the timeline. So this movie was just 3 months after the invasion.
We invade, and then it's right. 3 months later, and then the rest of the movie takes place in like a week, I thought.
Well, no, the title card is 4 weeks later.
Yeah, 4 weeks later. So Mission Accomplished was 4 weeks after the invasion.
Because you had that bit before the opening, which is the general's house, where all the bombs and everybody's trying to get out of his house, and then Green Zone 4 weeks later, and then you have the action of the movie. But I don't have a sense for how time passes in the actual movie, but my feeling is it's only a day or two.
Yeah, because they get Freddy. Freddy's like day one of the adventure.
Oh, right. Yeah, they can't have him sticking around that long.
No. 10 months, one leg, 2 girls, 1 cup.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between.
No one's going to see this movie.
I mean, no one's listened to it yet because it hasn't gone up yet.
Let's see.
Yeah, the listeners are listening to it now in their time.
Oh, there's one other thing. I'm sorry to try to delve. I apologize. I apologize for delving us back into the movie. But there was one thing that really freaked me out, it was in the briefing where they're all in the briefing, and it's early in the movie. You know what I'm talking about?
The military
scene,
right?
What freaked you out? We don't know.
There's a couple guys up there giving the briefing that are clearly not actors. They're soldiers. And I think they use soldiers throughout this film. In fact, there's a moment where Matt Damon tells a guy to get his game face on, and I think the guy he's actually talking to is an actual soldier. I think they use a lot of soldiers.
I think he might get an effing game face on. Doesn't he drop an F-bomb in that line?
Yeah, he did, but I'm trying to be more exclusive.
I remember that line, Dingus, because I was like, that F-bomb felt forced.
It did. But it felt like he was talking to a real guy. But in the briefing, there's one guy who's awkward, and then there's another guy who's awkward, and he's a bald dude. He's kind of a big, bald dude who's given the briefing, and he's really awkward.
Oh, yeah.
And he does a poor job of it. Well, I know that guy. I don't know him personally, but I've read his book. He wrote this book called Chasing Ghosts, and his name's Paul Rykoff. And Paul Rykoff runs this Iraq and Afghanistan of America veterans group called IAV. And I've seen him on TV before, and he's great on TV. He's fine. But he's very much an outspoken advocate for veterans and critic of how the war was run. And so when I saw him, I thought, oh, okay, well, if this guy is in this movie, then he's clearly sort of signed on. Either he's an advisor or he has some feel for the message of this movie. And it was weird for me to see this guy because he's a guy I respect, and I've read his book, as I said. And then it was weird to see the movie sort of devolve into this sort of clunky political problem. Although now that I think about it, as Tom has already mentioned, the politics of the movie aren't necessarily askew
right.
with what I believe. It's just it's just a mess of a film. So sorry to drive us
now, off. I recognized him too, actually, but I didn't read the book. But yeah, he tricks you into thinking the movie's going to be more
authentic. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
Where did they shoot this?
Spain and
Morocco.
Yeah, it's Morocco, okay. Tom. Morocco's our Iraq.
All right. Are we ready for 3x3? Dingus, you ready to introduce it?
Yeah, I am.
What? Where's the music?
Oh, well, we are. Oh, okay.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, or maybe the.
Okay, now 3x3 for real. Dingus, what do you got
on this? We can't hear it.
I miss hearing it. I don't know if I can go on without hearing it.
All right, Dingus, what do you got for us?
What if that's the only part that comes out?
That's going to be awesome.
All right, what do you got for us, Dingus?
Did you actually play the music? Because neither of us heard it.
Yes, I played the music twice. It's been playing. What do you got for us? What's this week's 3x3?
I love that sigh, by the way. Today's 3x3 for this episode is the your three best
1, 2, 3, not only you.
Managers in film. And I'm going first, right?
You do not get to go first. That's me, because I am introducing next week's 3x3.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm scared.
Yeah.
I'm scared for both of these things.
Inspired, by the way, by The Green Zone, but we'll get to that later. All right, so I had a hard time with this because I wanted to not just do war movies, and that's I was successful with one of them, but we'll get to that one in a minute. The first one I picked, and I don't think this movie holds up, is Platoon. Not necessarily for the depiction of soldiers specifically, but for this idea that there are good and evil soldiers. There is Elias on one hand and Barnes on the other. You know, Willem Dafoe is the good guy soldier in Vietnam, and Tom Berenger is the bad guy soldier in Vietnam, struggling for the soul of Charlie Sheen.
Pot is good, alcohol is evil.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There you go. So I don't necessarily – it's not – like I said, I doubt the movie holds up, but I like that concept that soldiers are neither good nor evil, but they make choices and they're pulled both ways. You know, they've got the good angel on one shoulder and the bad angel on the other one, and it's up to them to choose. So I kind of like that as an idea. So there's my number three is Platoon. Kelly Warren, you are second.
I kept taking Platoon off because I really like Platoon, but there's something that's affected and retarded about it for my taste. Like in hindsight, if it's on.
Yeah, I don't
it's just,
think
so. It just doesn't. I mean, he was a real soldier too, and he did all that, and he kind of is the Charlie Sheen character, Oliver Stone. So there is an authenticity quality to Platoon that I should be more impressed by. But somehow when I see it, it just seems so artificial. And so, I don't know. As opposed to my number three, I had trouble coming up with non-war ones, too. And here's a line from my number three.
Okay.
You have to name the movie.
All right. Well, me or Dingus has this. We totally got it.
Actually, it's two lines. Do you ever get lonely? Only around people.
Dingus, I'm going to hand this one over to you.
Ah, weak.
It sounds familiar. Does that count?
Oh, well, I'm sure this is on both your lists, or one of yours. Thin Red Line, Terrence Malick's.
Ah.
Well, that was all you, Tom. You should have gotten that.
I know.
Rich Man's Platoon, The Rich Man's Full Metal Jacket, The Rich Man Saving Private Ryan, Terrence Malick,
Well, I specifically was thinking of Nick Nolte in that, just as the, you know, as a commanding officer dealing with things like getting his men water and thinking about his own son at home. And I've talked before about the scene where John Travolta and his mustache are briefing Nick Nolte. So, yeah, that Thin Red Line is a good one that, again, because I was trying to get away from war movies, I didn't put it on my list, but I love that one. Yeah.
It's probably my favorite war movie.
Yep.
I think the problem with war movies is anything, a lot of them whitewash war, like a lot of the early ones, the ones that are, I think are considered the greatest war films of all time, like ones made during World War II. I mean, even The Great Escape to me is kind of like, I think Concentration Camp's a little more hardcore than The Great Escape suggests. So I would like to see a Terrence Malick version of Concentration Camp. But Thin Red Line to me is always, when I think of war films, I think of Thin Red Line first, because it's just so, even though there's a scene with Clooney at the end and a scene with Travolta at the beginning, and there's a lot of that sense of like big stars just doing one scene, that whole part, the whole middle, the whole battle of Guadalcanal is so perfectly, just the way things slowly, just, I don't know.
Well, as a way of presenting soldiers, it just presents so many different kinds of soldiers and so many different kinds of light. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of it's just done through their expressions. I mean, there's a few voiceovers, but you just remember. I don't know. It's the only war movie I can think of where you get a sense of panic from pretty much every soldier on screen for most of the movie.
I love Woody Harrelson. Realizing that he's blown his own ass off with his things like that, and who remembers? Did you remember that John Cusack storms a machine gun nest?
Yeah, with Adrian Brody and.
Oh, that's right. Adrian Brody was supposed to be the lead in that too, and apparently got all sorts of footage cut out. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and a bunch of guys did stuff that got cut too, like Viggo Mortensen was in it.
No way! Wow.
Yeah.
Did any of his footage survive?
I haven't seen it.
Wow.
Probably on a cutting room floor somewhere. But other people, a lot of people were in it. Robert Duvall, Martin Sheen.
Stop. Now you're just making up stuff.
Martin Sheen, yes. I am making up Robert Duvall.
Did the other guy who was going to play Aragorn, was he in there as well?
Daniel
Day-Lewis, stop it.
Billy Bob Thornton, Gary Oldman, Bill Pullman, Lucas Haas, Viggo Mortensen, and Mickey Rourke were all in it, but their scenes were eventually cut.
Wow. That makes me love the movie even more.
Right.
By the way.
That's how much Thin Red Line there could have been.
Wow.
Can you imagine just sitting around watching raw footage from that film?
Yeah, totally.
I would love to.
I feel like we are.
Me too.
Which makes it, and that's the only movie I don't know. I love Malick, and that's one of my favorite Malicks.
Yep. All right. Good.
What can you really say about Thin Red Line that, if you haven't seen it?
You dingus.
I'm done talking now.
All right, my number three. What I was going for here when I was making my list were three specific soldiers and what I liked about the depiction of those soldiers. And this the third slot was going to a fairly silly but a very exciting one, but then I dropped it when I couldn't get this one off my mind. And this soldier's name is Paul, played by Lou Ayres, I'm not sure if that's how you say his name.
Oh.
And it's from a movie called All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, you stole mine, bastard.
I apologize.
Yeah,
go ahead, Kelly.
It's my number two. Go on.
All right. Well, I would certainly be happy to discuss this with you. I think we've talked about it before. But this film shocked me because I saw it. It's been quite a few years since I've seen it. I just didn't expect it to be this movie. I don't know what I was expecting. I guess I thought any old movie would be rah-rah about war.
Yeah.
And the two classroom scenes really had an effect on me, and the way this character reacts to the classroom scene at the end and what he decides to do, it's just such an incredible essence for me of what a soldier, how a soldier acts in war, and how you can't
divorce your humanity from being a soldier. And that just had such an effect on me. And I keep meaning to see the movie again, and I haven't seen it in so many years, but I just couldn't leave it off this list.
Well, Kelly, yeah, you want to get in there? Because it's your number two. We now know.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
Sorry. I love that movie, and it really is an amazing film because just the fact that it was made in 1930,
right?
And it so doesn't whitewash war, and it's like it was made. And the combat sequences are pretty visceral too. Like they're, if I remember right, doesn't someone get their arms blown off?
Yeah.
By a mine or something. Like there's a lot of hardcore. And another scene that stands out for me is where he sees his new recruits and they're like little kids, basically, because they've run out of 18-year-olds and 16-year-olds. So he's like, each progressive set of recruits just keeps getting younger and younger. And also that last shot where his hand's reaching for the butterfly.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets shot by a sniper. Spoiler alert. But the actor, Lou Ayres, wasn't available, so that's actually the director, Lewis Milestone's hand. And somehow the fact that you don't see his face because you couldn't show it, it just makes it so much more poignant.
I had no idea. That's fascinating.
Tom, you didn't see that movie?
You know what? I haven't. You guys are making me want to see it. I love the book. I'm well acquainted with the book. But no, I've never seen the movie because, it's one of those old movies. Who has time to watch those?
What you should do is get that, and then it can sit next to Gunga Din on your shelf.
I've had Gunga Din for months now.
I get the sense that movie is not seen because then we fought the Germans World War II, like 10 years after that, and then maybe anything that showed anything from the German point of view was probably shelved or something.
It's not seen because the word quiet is in it. And I don't think people want to watch movies about quiet.
But it's ironical.
Right.
It has Western in the title, and people like Westerns, though.
Yeah, it's true. It's The Quiet Man, though. Not many people are watching that either.
All right. My number two is my only successful attempt to not put a war movie in here. I was trying to think of movies that have characters who were soldiers. And this one, nobody's seen this. You guys think nobody's seen All Quiet on the Western Front. Nobody's seen this or even heard of it. It's from a Jack Ketchum novel, which that might tell you something right there. Yeah. And it's directed by two guys. No one guy could direct this movie, one of whom is a Swedish fellow. I'm going to try to say his name. Trygve Alistair Deason is one of the directors. The other one, I can say this guy's name, it's much easier, is Lucky McKee, who did May.
Also Swedish. Oh, I love May.
May is great.
Yeah.
So he did a movie with Brian Cox called Red, and it's based on Jack Ketchum novel. Isn't Hank Ketchum the Dennis the Menace fella? Jack Ketchum does these like gory horror novels. Anyway, Red is about a guy. It's basically first, but it's the reluctant veteran. It's that trope where the reluctant veteran is basically bullied into action. He usually is avenging his family, or if it's like First Blood, it's just people just keep pushing him. So he has to snap into veteran mode and marshal all of his combat training, and it becomes like a revenge story. So Red is Brian Cox playing a Korean War veteran who's just out fishing with his dog, and some punks shoot his dog. And I love the way it subverts this idea that a veteran who then gets in touch with his violent side to avenge what's been done. And I don't know if it's from the book, but the twist at the end of the movie for why Brian Cox is doing what he's doing, and it has to do with him having seen war and some other terrible things that he's endured that get revealed. I love that twist, and I love how it basically says, look, veterans don't have to harness, they don't have to resort to violence for revenge. That's not the only skill they got out of being soldiers. So I love that part of Red, and that's why that's my number two pick.
I did not know there was a movie. I have the book but have not read it yet.
Have you read Jack Ketchum before?
Yeah, I've read Off Season, and I read Girl Next Door. I like him. I think he's a great writer.
yeah, I've never, I'm curious. Yeah, I've never read his stuff, and I know about Girl Next Door. I saw another
half read, yeah,
based on that story that I just couldn't stomach. Yeah, all right. So
he's
I do
like he's kind of like Joe Lansdale,
right? Right,
but less rednecky.
It's kind of like Gran Torino.
The less redneck.
You know what Dingus said is another one. Yeah, so Gran Torino is like Red, but stupid.
I know, I was going to say it's yeah. Like the intelligent version of Gran Torino.
Well, are you calling the dogs Koreans, Tom? Are you being racist?
So the poor thing, I mean, Gran Torino, they both...
Nice to see Kelly.
Can we spoil Project. Gran Torino? I don't know.
That's already been done by the...
The director did a fine job of that. But Gran Torino, though, it's the same thing. He's the reluctant veteran, and he takes revenge, but it does subvert it. Like, what he does at the end of Gran Torino isn't what you think he's going to do.
Yeah.
So
it's the opposite of what you want him to do.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
And Red understands that in a very different way, by the way. So Red isn't a great movie. It's a little weird, and it's got a terrible, terrible... female reporter role, which is just almost ruins it. But just watching Brian Cox. Brian Cox is so good in it. What's that, Kelly?
She worked for the Wall Street Journal, and she's there to blow the lid off.
She's going to find the truth about Red.
Swamps.
Yeah. All right, so that's my number two. Kelly Wand, we know you're number two.
Yeah.
You got that All Quiet on the Western Front. So, Dingus, over to you. What's your number two best favorite portrayal of soldiers in film?
All right, I'll give you fellas a quote. How you like that?
Awesome. I love quotes. Always fun. People love listening to us. I don't know.
Are you ready?
Rock and roll.
Just watch your corner. Get all your men back here alive.
Black Hawk Down.
Yep, you got it. How did you nail that?
I'm just that good.
Is Black Hawk Down as good as I remember it being? I remember really liking it.
Not quite, but it is very good. How's that work for an answer, Dingus? Would you
is it the best Josh Hartnett movie?
No, please.
That's Pearl Harbor.
That's the Virgin Springs.
That's lucky number 11.
Black Hawk Down is not as good as you remember it, but the key is watch it after watching Green Zone.
Oh, well, I'm sure Pearl Harbor looks good after watching Green Zone.
Don't say that. Nothing. No. I'm going to...
Tom's a Michael Bay apologist. No.
Let me just say this. The portrayal of soldiers in Black Hawk Down is phenomenal. There's a lot of cheesy stuff that Ridley Scott does in Black Hawk Down that I didn't remember, and watching it again that made me cringe a little bit. But the combat... and the way soldiers react to one another is phenomenal. And the soldier I'm picking specifically is Eric Bana. Eric Bana's soldier, Hoot, who's one of the Delta Force or Special Forces guys. And the movie's chock full of soldiers I could pick, but I wanted to really focus on one guy in each of the films they picked. And so I'm picking Eric Bana as Hoot in Black Hawk Down because I love the way I'd read Mark Bowden's book before seeing this film. And there's just so many great little bits about how the soldiers acted and how the Delta guys acted that was different than normal soldiers. And the movie gets a lot of this, but specifically Eric Bana gets it. He gets how to make it clear that he's different without being a total ass. And he's able to help the other guys while still being a badass. And he gives Josh Hartnett a couple bits of advice in the beginning and at the end. And he just does a number of nice little touches. His accent is really a problem, much more of a problem than I remembered. But I really didn't care because I just loved how his attitude came across and how he's tough and still so compassionate. And he does this thing that made me think of Hurt Locker at the end when he talks about he's about to head back out after everybody comes back in. He's about to head back out, and Josh Hartnett's gathering his stuff as if he's going to go along. And Eric Bana says, no, mate, you stay here. I'm better on my own. And he says something about, you know, people back home will ask me if I'm a war junkie or an adrenaline junkie. I don't know the actual lines. And he says they just don't get it. It's just about the man next to you, and that's all that it's about. And that sense of it being about the man next to you And I also have a very personal reaction to this film because I saw it with my father-in-law who was in Vietnam, and he had a very, very profound reaction to seeing this film when we saw it in theaters. And we ended up staying up very late, just the two of us talking and smoking cigars and drinking scotch and talking about combat, which he couldn't talk. He doesn't talk about very much. But this film really brought it out in him. And still, when he mentions this film, I can see sort of there's a difference in it. This film had an effect on him because the combat and the way the soldiers react to each other is quite profound. So yeah, this is my number 2, Black Hawk Down, and The Soldier is Hoot by Eric Bana.
Eric Bana does not call Josh Hartnett mate, does he?
I might be imagining that, but I'm almost certain he does.
Wow. Ouch. Because it's like in full, his accent, is he trying to cover his Australian accent, or are they pretending that he's from Australia?
No, he's trying to, he's doing like a southern, sort of a generic southern accent. But in the beginning, you can definitely hear, I mean, it's worse than, this is...
Ewan McGregor's American accent?
This could be our second Avatar apology of the week. It's worse, I think, than Sam Worthington. But you don't care, because he's solid. He's just solid.
Who's Sam Worthington?
No, but shut up.
No. Something about Black Hawk Down that I remember thinking was great and why Green Zone doesn't work is that what's happening in the movie on a macro level goes with what's happening in the movie, like just on a moment by moment basis. Like the fact that we're in over our heads and the whole theme of no man being left behind versus cutting and running when it's like strategically feasible to do so.
Well, the incident in Somalia was very different. It's sort of like, well, I don't want to get too much into what we talked about with Green Zone, but the incident in Somalia was much smaller and sort of more intimate and more direct than everything that happened in Iraq, and certainly with the Black Hawk crashing. And it helps, too, Kelly Wand, I think, that the novel is so meticulous and the source material for Black Hawk Down is just so much stronger than whatever crap got cooked up for Green Zone, I think.
Well, you're absolutely right, Tom.
Yeah.
And I was actually, I wanted to mention this during the talk about Green Zone, but I didn't because I just didn't want to bring up Black Hawk Down yet. But it's fascinating to me, and I'm not going to give any spoilers about Green Zone, but it's fascinating to me to see the way Black Hawk Down handles its exposition, which is largely through lines of text at the beginning and here and there, as opposed to the way Green Zone handles its exposition. And it's interesting to see these two work against each other.
Well, also, Black Hawk Down, the incident kind of happens in the movie about like what we know happened, and it's based on a book about an actual incident, while as Green Zone, like Tom implied, is based on nothing really except a book on what Iraq's like.
Right, and again, the book, yeah, we can't get back into that. But,
right.
All right, so my number one favorite portrayal of soldiers, and I'm surprised I didn't think of this earlier, and unfortunately it is a war movie, at least the second half of it, but I just love the first half of Full Metal Jacket and how it really is about what you have to do to become a soldier. And you have to take relatively normal dudes and subject them to some serious behavior modification. It's a necessary evil, I think, to condition men to shoot at other men and be shot at. And I love how it's part of why I think soldiers deserve respect, is what they undergo and the type of job they have to do and the type of person you have to become to do that job. The first part of Full Metal Jacket, I love how it's about that. And I don't know how realistic it is. I don't know how stylized all that stuff is, but Arlie Ermey's drill instructor whipping these guys into shape. It's very entertaining. It's very funny in a way. But one of my favorite parts of it is later in the movie when he settles down and he's just talking to them, teaching them things. And it's such a stark contrast to the sort of the poetry of profanity he has. When he's finally explaining to them, I think there's a scene where they're about to do their sniper training or whatever, and he's just like calmly talking to them. He's giving them a lecture. And when he even says something fairly kind to Vincent D'Onofrio, but I think we found something you're good at, you get this sense that he actually cares for these guys and he even loves them. And I love that kind of relationship and that kind of psychological cauldron is part of what makes, I think it's a large part of what makes soldiers unique and why they deserve respect. And I love how that's laid out in the first half of Full Metal Jacket, which unfortunately then goes on to be a fairly typical Vietnam War movie.
It loves you long time, Tom. isn't the first half of that movie just about one guy's breakdown, though?
Well,
and
it's
beating him with soap. That's what I remember.
I mean, it's
about how a bunch of people react to the same breakdown.
Okay.
No, it's about breaking people down and building them up.
Yeah, it's the group dynamics
and the consequences of doing that too,
and the dangers of it. Yeah, I mean, this sort of behavior modification is not without its dangers, and the military, to its credit, usually avoids this. I mean, people get trained to shoot at other men and try to kill them, and they don't generally crack and go crazy from it. But that is a danger when that's a part of what happens when you make soldiers and what you have to deal with when you make soldiers. You know, how do they reintegrate into normal life?
Well, it did give us Arlie Ermey. Can't really argue. He is probably the apotheosis of soldiers on screen.
Certainly drill sergeants, yeah. Dingus, give us a line from Full Metal Jacket. Go. How do you do on a family podcast?
Yeah, I was going to say, can I say that line? And I don't think I can.
What is your malfunction?
Major. You haven't the common courtesy to give him a what?
A helping hand.
Helping hand. Very nice.
You don't have
to be something to do with the duality of man. This podcast.
All right, so there's my number one. Kelly Wand, what is your number one favorite portrayal of soldiers in film?
Well, obviously, any of you guys call me Francis and I'll kill you.
Lord.
Lighten
just
up,
kidding.
Francis.
Yeah.
I'm putting it down for stripes. I'm sorry. I already wrote it down.
Oh, that was a joke. That was my joke.
No, I wrote it down. It's number one.
I wrote it down, too. It's locked and loaded. We're in the pipe, 5x5.
I was looking online because I was stuck on my number one for a while. So there's a site called ePinions. It's just like random nerds, top 10 war movies.
This is
and
your wrote, pick, not theirs?
No, wait. He goes, honorable mentions, Band of Brothers, TV series, not a movie. And then he wrote, MASH, TV series, not a movie. And then I went, the internet sucks. So then I stopped looking. But my number one is Gallipoli, which I think is a bad choice because it's sort of more about, it's not really about soldiers specifically. But after Tom did Full Metal Jacket, I feel a little more secure about it. Because it's about what soldiers are before they become soldiers, too. Mm-hmm. Like sprinters. And the last shot just sums it up.
That is sort of the darker side of, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and I can't spoil it because it's too good a movie.
Everybody's seen Gallipoli, of course you can.
Have they?
Sure. Who hasn't seen Gallipoli? Raise your hand. Look at that, nobody raised their hand.
I almost went with Breaker Morant. Do you guys ever see that movie?
I don't remember Breaker Morant real well.
But it's more about a court case.
Yeah, yeah.
And I almost went with Seven Samurai. But then I thought,
by the way, Kelly Wan, you might be trumping Dingus's number one.
Yeah, just keep naming films, Kelly Wants. Brian Brown films, whatever films you want to name, just keep naming them.
Because we know your number one is probably Empire Strikes Back, so.
Yeah, I love those stormtroopers. They're awesome.
Gallipoli's great. Now, whatever happened to the dude who plays Mel Gibson's best friend in Gallipoli? Did he ever go on to do more movies? And who is he?
Danny Glover.
He's getting too old for that shit.
Who's the other actor in Gallipoli, Kelly Wants?
Mark Lee is his name.
Whatever became of him?
He played Archie Hamilton in Gallipoli. Oh, you mean after that?
Did he go on to do anything? I mean,
he was in Star Wars.
He's Australian, so he's the Australian guy who didn't make it.
He's like the Australian Mel Gibson.
Right. He kind of like he's the Australian Paul Walker, Tom.
Good.
He's in a bunch of Australian movies. And TV stuff. So he had an illustrious career, but not of anything we've seen.
An illustrious local career. That's good. Okay. Yeah, Gallipoli is great. I haven't seen it in a long time, but that's vintage Peter Weir.
It's got synthesizer music in it, which is usually an annoyance to me, especially in a period piece. The way, what was that Johnny Depp gangster movie? Outlaw.
Public Enemy.
Public Enemy.
Public Enemy.
Yeah, I remember in the previews to that, it just played like this rock music, but it was like supposed to be about John Dillinger in the 20s.
We're never going to remember anything about a train.
That always annoys me. Well, it didn't have it in the movie, did it? Because I didn't see it.
Anyway,
I feel it's, I don't know. It's like The Deer Hunter, but Australian. And The Deer Hunter was almost on this list, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure we've covered Dings as number one by now.
I don't know.
Have we not mentioned your number one, or is it going to be Rushmore?
Because he plays a soldier in one of those school plays they put on.
Well, no, because Bill Murray was in The Shit.
That's right.
You see a Vietnam War.
That's right.
Did you
soldiers good?
No.
All right.
Now, speaking of Mel Gibson, yeah.
You know how much I love my Mel Gibson. It's one I missed.
Although, I don't know, that might be, Kelly Wan, that might be Dingus's number one. I don't know. We've
is the Bruce Willis one good?
Bruce Willis, We Were Soldiers?
No.
The one where he's in a World War II camp with Colin Farrell?
No.
Tears of the Sun.
Never mind.
I don't know what you're talking about, Kelly Wand, but it might be Dingus's number one. Dingus, is Bruce Willis in your number one?
No. He could be.
Is your number one just the quote, that Bruce Willis movie? Set to Vietnam. Is that what it says?
Yes, it's Bruce Willis Fall 2010 Project.
Underrated. Hearts War?
Yeah, that's the thing where he's in a World War II, like prisoner of war camp with Colin Farrell.
Yeah, it's the Colin Farrell thing.
Yeah. All right. Nobody's seen that, please.
But Tears of the Sun's Vietnam, right?
I don't know. It's Antoine Fuqua, isn't it? Isn't Tears of the Sun? Who's the chick in that? Gabrielle and
Monica Bellucci.
Oh. Ray Don Chong.
You're both fired. Dingus, over to you. What's your number one favorite portrayal of soldiers in film? Because I got to hear what you have that tops Black Hawk Down.
I also can't believe none of you have mentioned it in all of your blurting out of movie.
We tried.
We really did.
Yeah, I'm stumped.
Yeah, you missed it. All right, here's my number one favorite portrayal of soldier in a film. And you know what I'm going to do right now?
Give us a quote.
I think I'm going to give you a quote.
Awesome.
Gentlemen, we are the flank.
General sucks, though, so it can't be that.
We are the flank. Food Nation?
What did you say, Kelly?
Gods and Generals. But that movie sucks.
No, it's so not Gods and Generals.
You wouldn't have gone with something that sucks. We are the flank. We are the
Avatar.
We are not in Kansas. We are the flank.
I don't know, Dave. That's so
Guns of Navarone.
That's way too general, Dingus. Can you give us a better, more specific line?
Force 10 from Navarone.
How about this? Now we see how professors fight.
Oh yeah, it's the Jeff Daniels thing. It is your Gods and Generals, not Gods and Generals. The one that you watched out of order.
Yeah.
What the hell is that thing? Is it Gods and Generals?
It's Gettysburg, you bitches. It's not Gods and Generals.
There's a movie called Gettysburg?
It's not really a movie so much as a three.
That doesn't count.
Ted Turner, made for TNT.
Wait a minute. That's so not acceptable to me. But it has to be in a theater, dude.
I think it did have a limited theatrical release.
It had a theatrical release. You already totally bonked my last week's one. Are you going to do this one too, Kelly Wand?
Oh, all right. Sounds fishy.
It's not fishy. And have you watched Gettysburg?
No, I should.
Then shut the fuck up.
No, you should. Gettysburg, I mean, I'm with you here, Dingus, but I'm not a fan of Gettysburg. But go ahead. I like what you're getting towards, and there's some cool stuff in there. But Gettysburg's kind of long and turgid.
Long and turgid is, I think that's actually the subtitle of the film, Gettysburg, Long and Turgid. It is awful, I think, in a lot of ways. And in a lot of ways, it looks like I took my camera out to Yorktown and had a bunch of my friends run around and jump off the rocks. It really looks horrible. But Jeff
so it's
Daniels,
better than Glory?
I don't know if I would say that. Jeff Daniels, okay, first of all, Tom alluded to this a moment ago. I watched this film out of order like a total moron. I got it from Netflix, and it was a double-sided disc, and like an idiot, I couldn't figure out which side to put on. I just stuck the disc in the player, and it just started with Martin Sheen, like, holding forth, and I was like, oh, that's weird. It just starts in the middle. Okay, let's watch. And then the credits ran. I was like, boy, this is much shorter than I was expecting. And then I turned it over, and there's the beginning of the movie. So I watched it all the way through again. And Jeff Daniels is a freaking revelation in this. He's amazing. Okay, so the soldier I'm dealing with here is Colonel Joshua Chamberlain. And the guy playing him clearly is Jeff Daniels from 1993's Gettysburg. And this is one of my favorite soldiers. I love him. And part of it is what Tom was talking about a moment ago when he was talking about Full Metal Jacket and how Arlie Ermey's character was teaching them, because this guy was a professor and he found himself as a guy in this battle of having to teach men how to fight. And there are moments when he's talking his speech in talking about telling them to refuse the line and how they're going to do this. It is overwrought, and there's a huge amount of problems with the movie. But I am just crazy about Jeff Daniels' performance as this soldier. And this is a part of our history that I didn't understand at all. I didn't understand the Civil War. I just didn't get it until and this is the second time.
And you owned slaves.
Exactly. The Murawskis were well known for that. The second time I'm going to reference my father-in-law, who pressed the book Killer Angels into my hands at some point, which is a beautiful historical novel about that this time about Gettysburg. And
if I'm not mistaken, Dingus, isn't the movie based on Killer Angels?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
and. This novelization helped me understand, because I didn't understand this part of our history. I was incurious as a high schooler and didn't really get it. And I finally started to understand. And this movie, while truly flawed, this particular performance brings to life the moment in a life of a citizen soldier or a man who has to be a soldier and has to help his men understand how to fight. And has to be brave. And just watching Jeff Daniels scream the word bayonets with this weird look in his eyes, and watching him teach his men and help his men and instruct his men. This I just love this soldier. I love this part of our history now because of as ham-handed as this film can be, this performance and this particular soldier is just beautiful. So that's my number one.
One of the problems with Gettysburg is that the spectacle of the battle scenes is upstaged by the spectacle of everyone's facial hair. That movie has some of the most amazing beards and mustaches you will ever see in your life.
It really does. You see Thomas Howell, and he's like he's got like a guinea pig on his face. And when one of you asked, I think, if Bruce Willis was in this film, I honestly couldn't answer the question.
Because well, that's what women were into back then, obviously. The Southern Belles, like the mutton chops.
Could be, yeah. All right, very good. So there we go. That's this week's 3x3. Whose turn is it for next week?
Wait, let me look at my notes.
So I'm gonna introduce next week's with so it's also a little inspired by Green Zone. There's not gonna be any spoilers, but I'm gonna introduce next week's 3x3. I did a little research and I came up with a quote that explains what we're gonna do next week. This is Alfred Hitchcock in an interview, and this is a direct quote Hitchcock explaining this term. He says, "It might be a Scottish name taken from a story about two men in a train. One man says, 'What's that package up there in the baggage rack?' And the other answers, 'Oh, that's a MacGuffin.' The first one asks, 'What's a MacGuffin?' 'Well,' the other man says, 'it's an apparatus for trapping lions in the Scottish Highlands.' And the first man says, 'But there are no lions in the Scottish Highlands.' And the other one answers, 'Well, then that's no MacGuffin.' So you see, a MacGuffin is nothing at all." So Hitchcock talked about the MacGuffin. The term had been around, I don't think he invented it. But a MacGuffin is something generally in an action movie that the good guy and the bad guy both desperately want, but that the audience doesn't necessarily care about. The audience is invested in the characters, but the characters have to be chasing something. So, for instance, the MacGuffin in Green Zone is, and I'm putting air quotes around this, the truth about WMDs. to preempt you guys, and what I want you guys to do next week is give me three memorable MacGuffins, because MacGuffins are normally forgettable and they don't matter. So I'm going to preempt you guys by ruling out a couple of them that I know you're going to want to pick.
The famous
MacGuffin, everybody knows, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and Raiders of the Lost Ark, or the plans to the Death Star. Those are examples of MacGuffins. Everybody also knows the MacGuffin in Pulp Fiction is just a glowing briefcase. Yeah, exactly. You can't go there. That's too easy.
What?
Yeah, too easy. I want you to come up
with... What's left, Tom? Nothing.
I know, exactly.
There are no other movies.
I just want three memorable MacGuffins. MacGuffins worth remembering. Because rarely are they. There are a few, though, and I want examples from you guys of MacGuffins worth remembering next week.
Just going to type in Alfred Hitchcock here.
That is dastardly good.
All right, so there you go. And speaking of MacGuffins, where there is nothing at all, how about we go see Repo Man?
Repo Man.
Good Lord. Well, by the way, there's another MacGuffin. Let me trump the radioactive alien in the trunk of a 57 Chevy Malibu. That's another MacGuffin that I'm knocking out of the running. So there.
Oh.
Speaking of Repo Man.
Let me cross that off.
I hate Tom.
I just want to make it challenging for you guys. I don't want you
Tom's
to...
our MacGuffin.
Yeah. He's our MacGuffin to bear.
So it turns out when I play this out, the music may not actually record. Who knows? So enjoy a moment of silence. Hopefully afterwards, Kelly Wan will weigh in with some final quip, a MacGuffin, if you will. And join us next week for Repo Men and our 3x3 of memorable MacGuffins. I am Tom Chick, and I have been joined with Christian Mikulowski?
Christian Freddie Morosky.
And Kelly Wand.
McCluskey?
There's some kind of way out of here. Say the joker to the thief.
Bad sign that we can't hear the music. Alan Smithy's a MacGuffin.